Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer and our old friends TJ Buchholz from Vanguard and Tom Shields from the Marketing Resource Group. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
We're only hours away from our first general election presidential debate. And TJ, I just learned something new. You were a college debater.
I was.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. You know, I have issues and challenges of calling things like we're going to see tonight as a debate.
Well, why is that? Because it seems like you should be there keeping score and keeping tally.
It's impossible to do that because, you know, in actual debates where there are rules and there are scoring, there's a specific order in which you do things. Tonight's effort is going to be nothing but a MMA fight opposed to a boxing match. It's who can pivot to their message fast enough, who can answer the question they wish had been asked. This is about speed tonight and not substance, and speed of getting to your talking points and making your point without answering the question.
Tommy, is this kind of a bucket of popcorn event for you, or are you going to need your pillow? Popcorn or pillow? What is this going to be for
you? I think that people want to see popcorn. I mean, they want to basically sit down and watch the entertainment. I mean, that's what they're looking for in this. And they're expecting all kinds of record numbers. I mean, breaking the old Carter-Reagan debate back in 1980, breaking the records for this. And I think people want to see some entertainment. So they want to see some jousting back and forth between the two candidates. I think they're looking forward to that.
Well, I'm personally going to be switching back and forth to the Monday Night Football game, and that's because I've got a receiver on my fantasy team who's playing for the New Orleans Saints. Jack, what's your thoughts going into this debate?
Well, I'm wondering, speaking about the Carter-Reagan debate, according to the legend, the Democrats had made Reagan look like such a monster that he practically won by just showing up and looking like a human. There have been comparisons to that debate in terms of Trump. If all he's got to do is show up and not foam at the mouth, and he wins. What do you think about that?
You know, overnight, I was actually surprised to see Trump's campaign manager say things to the media like Trump is the Babe Ruth of debating. They're not setting low expectations for him as have been done in the past for candidates. They're saying that Trump is going to come in and blow the doors off. And if that's true, what I think you're going to see tonight, to use a football analogy, as maybe Kyle will appreciate, is it's a team that is all offense versus a team that's all defense.
What do you think of that idea, Tom?
I agree with Jack. I think the expectations for Trump are low. I mean, he's supposed to be unfit for office. He doesn't really understand the issues. He's never been on a national stage like this before in a one-on debate. The expectations are low for the general public. But his campaign, right, he never admit that in his life. He absolutely is setting himself up that he's going to knock down, drag down, and he's going to win this thing no matter what. So, but I think, though, the general public looking at this, especially Republicans who have been on the fence on this guy, are going to basically see, is he presidential? Does he come across, does he handle the issues well? Does he not make any personal attacks or go over the edge, you know, on her? And I think from that standpoint, they're going to judge him on whether or not he wins or loses this thing. I think in their minds, does he come off? And Reagan had the exact same problem. I mean, if Reagan was basically accused of being, you know, you can't trust this guy with his hand on the button. And he was looking at being sort of a Goldwater guy. And you really can't trust him on a national stage. And he did have low expectations in that debate. And he came up, you know, winning hand over fist, I think, in that debate. But expectations were really low going in.
I've never seen a team embrace anti-intellectualism more for debate prep than I've ever seen in this particular race. Trump, they've said multiple times that Trump is best when he's unprepared, that he's best when he's on his feet, when he's best when he's extemporaneous. And that is fine. But again, it comes back to my point where this is not a debate then, because we're not talking about substance. We're not talking about issues that Americans care about. All we're talking about is flash. All we're talking about this being an extended episode of The Apprentice, where at some point Trump says to Clinton, you're fired, with a point of his finger. I mean, that's adorable, but, you know, there's lots of different channels on TV where I can see that written better in Hollywood than Washington can.
Well, here's my question, and from watching the presidential debates prior during the primary, Donald Trump is on the stage with multiple people. And when you break it down, I mean, how much time did Donald Trump actually have in front of the camera? I mean, he had more than the other people on the stage. But when it boiled right down to it, what did he have, maybe 10, 15 minutes? This is an hour and a half debate, and he's going to have to chew up 40 minutes. And how many times can you say, it's going to be awesome, it's going to be great, I'm going to make America great again? Because you've got to fill it with some kind of specifics, right? And so far, if nothing else, his campaign has been very void of specifics. So what does he say during all that time? Whereas Hillary Clinton seems to have spoken a lot more substantive material during her one-on-one debates with Bernie Sanders.
In debate, you look at affirmative and negative, 1A, 1N, 2A, 2N, with debate and rebuttal. So It's easier in a debate. It's just like in a courtroom. It's easier to be the defense attorney than it is the prosecutor because, you know, all you have to create if you're the defense is reasonable doubt. If you're on the negative side of a debate, all you have to do is poke holes in the argument. You don't necessarily have to make points of your own. So if Trump is taking the negative position in this debate, and I'm putting debate in quotes, all he has to do is poke holes in Hillary Clinton's what she terms to be substantive policy issues. And again, the challenge, though, is there's no editing here. This is not an NBC reality TV show. There's absolutely no editing for this, and I find it difficult to believe that he's going to be able to chew up that much time. I agree with you.
Well, I think he's going to chew it up. He's going to chew it up the same way he's been chewing it up from there. I don't think he's going to necessarily change. I think he's going to add a little bit more detail because he's rolled out some plans over the last month. But I think he's still going to stick on the same message. I think he's going to stick on the same message of, listen, he's using a lot more we than he is I anymore. He's getting on the side of the voter. He says we're going to make him, you know, he's going to do this patriotic, we're going to make America great again. I think he's going to send that same kind of upbeat message probably in every single answer that he does. I just think that he really is going to go that route. Why change something that he thinks is working?
You got to remember, though, too, I mean, Trump has been giving these 90-minute speeches three times a day for, the past 3 months. So in terms of him not being able to come up with things, now, will they be repetitious? You know, very possibly. But I'm not sure that's where he's going to have the problem. I think it's just controlling himself and not saying some of the things that has gotten him in trouble in the past. That's where I think, you know, it's going to take a mental effort.
Well, Trump's other issue is timing. There are some rules to this effort tonight. There are some times where he's got to make some points in minutes. He's got to be prepared for some rebuttal. It's not the same as speaking to a crowd and 35,000 people in Alabama where he can pontificate about, you know, whatever he wants to talk about. There are rules. There are going to be an opportunity to challenge him. It'll be interesting to me to see how he pivots into answering questions about his policies or lack thereof. Now, I would say that to say this. This guy is seasoned. To Jack's point, you know, just because he's been on the stage from January to May debating his counterparts, even though these have been 4, 5, 6-way efforts, he has some experience doing this. He's not brand new to it. But to say that prep is bad and that preparation and thinking about it is bad, that's a pathway to a quick defeat.
Tom, you brought some numbers here that Vegas has actually put some odds out right now on certain things. Read a little bit of that to us.
There actually, sportsbook.eg has a bets you can place here. And 1-4 that they're going to shake hands when they come out. It's 13-2 that they're actually going to kiss and hug.
How about kiss on the lips?
That may be off the charts. the over and under on the viewership is 99.5 million, which would be 20% more than watched the Reagan-Carter debate back in 1980 if we got to that point in time. There's other odds here, like whether or not they mention certain words, whether or not they mention the word deportation or deport, or it's over and under is 6-5, over that. But there's all kinds of things that are out there that weren't out there in 1980 that you can do these days that makes this interesting. And that social media and everything else, I think it is going to set records. I think the first one will. I'm not sure the second or third one will, but I think the first one absolutely will set records for a number of people watching. And again, I mentioned the people are looking to be entertained. They're looking for something, and they're looking for a knockdown, drag-out fight if they can possibly find it. And I think Trump will give them some excitement. I think he's going to go in, and thinking he needs to do well and win this thing. And I think he's going to say some things that will, get a laugh or get a reaction or will say something. But he hasn't been preparing anywhere near what Hillary's basically been sequestered for the last week.
Well, part of that is probably to make sure that she's in good health before she goes out there, too. Kind of steering away from the debate a little bit, but staying on the election track here. TJ, do you think this election has been good for the country?
No. I feel like it has demonstrated that two people with very polarized differences of opinion can influence the middle-of-the-road electorate. I think as we've continued down this path, these two candidates, for better or for worse, have completely polarized of the electorate. And I'm worried about the damage that it can do to our process in the future. I'll make it more simple. If you are paying any kind of attention to this race at all, and you are undecided, I think there's something wrong with you. The choices have never been clearer about the differences between two candidates. I mean, we're not talking about nuanced things. We're talking about black and white, day and night, salt and pepper. I mean, two completely different things. I ultimately don't think that's good, because I think bulk of America is more middle of the road than the top of the ticket currently demonstrates.
Tom, do you think that Gary Johnson should be on the stage? Or are you okay with the current rules as they stand?
You know, 15%, that was the rule. Everybody knew that going in. They didn't change anything. I think that's fair. I mean, if they want to change it to 10 or whatever they want to make it, you know, but that was the rule going in, so I think that's fair. You know, he knew what he had to get in the polls in order to get on the stage.
How come he can't get to 10?
Well, I mean, now last poll, I only showed him at 5.
Yeah, and I know. That's what I'm saying.
He's coming out over the weekend. And so I think what's happened, most of his vote was coming from those people who just felt very uncomfortable with Donald Trump ticket. You know, in the last month, he's changed his rhetoric a little bit. He's reading from a teleprompter. He's not going off the deep end. He's not criticizing anybody as bad as he was in the past. So I think they're feeling a little bit more comfortable when they're coming back home. I think that's what's happening here. So you see Johnson's numbers, dwindling. You know, Stein's never gotten up to 5%. So, those Bernie Sanders voters have pretty much come back home pretty much to Hillary. So there'll be some out there still that are far left and the far right that have problems with it, with Trump. But, you know, I think Republican voters are coming back home. Democrat voters have been there for a while.
What about this theory that there's all these people who can potentially vote for Trump who just have laid off elections for several years now, and so they're not considered likely voters? If that were the case, wouldn't we be seeing increases in new registration? Would there be some kind of telltale sign if that was going to happen?
You know, anecdotally, I hear this all the time. I mean, I was up in Saginaw last week, and I was talking to the chairman of the Republican Party, and Trump campaign had opened up a separate office, actually in the same mall they're in. And she said that she went down and said, gee, maybe we should consolidate our offices and work together. And she said, I've got people coming in here who would never step foot in the Republican office. I got volunteers coming in here. You know, every Trump sign you see out there, someone paid $5 or $15 for. No freebie signs out there by anybody yet. So, I mean, they're different voters, you're right. And there's a possibility that they're not getting included, because when we start with a list, we start with, you know, do our polling, we start a list of registered voters. So, but high frequency voters too. So there's a possibility they're not being included in this poll. And what may happen on the turnout, who knows? But, you know, Trump got more Republican votes than any Republican candidate in history in the primaries, you know, more than anybody, Reagan or Bush, Romney or anybody else. There's people, and they weren't necessarily all Republican. So he's bringing people out of the woodwork here. We'll see if they show up on general election day. Who knows?
TJ, do you believe the polls?
I think it's difficult to track what the electorate feels right now. I think that there are certainly people when you dial them that tell you one thing and maybe vote another. Again, that's anecdotal. I think that it's becoming an increasing difficult target to hit for a lot of reasons. One is the way that we do polling, I think, needs to change substantively. The percentage of people who have cell phones is increasing rapidly. The standard has been to try and get a 20% cell sample in a poll. I think that needs to increase dramatically to really capture how people are feeling. But I think that because the top of the ticket is so polarized right now, and it's two completely black and white different black and white kind of choices, you have people who, when you call them, don't want to tell you how they're voting. I would say I've never run into more, especially older people, who say, you know, who I'm going to vote for is a secret. And I'm not going to tell you who I'm voting for.
Right.
That's happening more. It always happens. That's a thing. But it's happening more this cycle, which tells me that people are kind of ashamed a little bit of who they're going to vote for, but they're going to cast a vote anyway. But you can't say, well, those are all Trump voters, because I don't think that that's true.
I don't think it is.
I think it's just people that are keeping their votes more close to the vest than they ever have before.
Maybe they don't want to get involved in a conversation, a back and forth, any kind of visceral discussion, and they feel like just saying, yes, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump is going to ignite something they just don't feel comfortable talking about.
And from a social media perspective, you know, you have people, you know, longtime people who have been in politics that say, you know what, from now until the election, I'm not going to talk about politics anymore. I've made my choice. You're not going to influence me either way. So you know what I'm going to put up from now on? Kittens. We'll put kittens up from now until November. That's happening a lot.
I've seen that. My relatives are doing that. I mean, they are finally basically called a truce, because they're on both sides of the aisle on this thing, and they finally just decided, truce, we're not putting up, we're just putting up grandkids' pictures now.
Another thing I've heard people talk about on the debate is that some people are flat out saying the candidate that can go positive, can show a positive view for the future, et cetera, with all the negatives out there, is the one that's going to have the upper hand. The part that I understand that, but the part that's kind of got me wondering, some of them are talking about doing that in the debate. And I'm wondering, is the debate, is a 90-minute debate someplace where you begin that process? Is that reasonable or is that realistic?
I think this is suspect to Tom's point, which is this is a moment where the most people who are going to pay attention in this election are paying attention. And again, I think that the viewership for this debate is going to be much higher than the second, third, and subsequent debates. But again, I think it's going to be important tonight for both candidates to make points. And my question is, what happens if somebody comes up with some sort of pie-in-the-sky point that hasn't been made before? And the example I gave was, you know, what if Hillary Clinton says tonight, gives a Kennedy sort of edict and says, you know what, in the course of my presidency, in the next 8 years, if you elect me, we're going to put a man on Mars.
Not colonize Mars, like Darren Johnson just said.
But we're going to put a man on Mars in 8 years. Something that's so far-reaching and so illustrative of her vision and goal, and that Trump has to respond to. Well, I'm going to put a whole colony on Mars, and it's going to be huge. You know,
it's going to be great.
Right. I mean,
make Mars great again.
The point is, this is an opportunity to make a cogent point, and I think that both candidates are going to be looking to do that.
And I think so, too. I think, you know, when it comes right down to it, people like to feel good about when they go to the ballot box. When they go and vote on the 8th, they want to feel good about their choices, and they want to do something positive, and I really think so. And I, as much as the negative stuff has dominated this campaign, I think people want to feel good about their choices, and I think the candidate that provides them, I think, with that positive choice is the one that's going to win in the end. That's going to be one that's going to tip people over the edge, those people who give them something that they can grab onto and say, you know what, I'm going to vote for Trump or I'm going to vote for Hillary because of X. And it's not because I'm anti-Trump. I mean, up until, you know, like the last polls, I mean, majority of people were voting for Trump because they were anti-Hillary. I mean, we had like 55% of the people passing the votes for Hillary were doing it as anti-Trump, and 52% of the people voting for Trump because they were voting anti-Hillary. And I think you've got to give people at some point in time something they can latch onto and say, this is the positive reason I'm voting for this guy.
Tom Shields from the Marketing Resource Group and TJ Buchholz from Vanguard, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you. Be fun tonight.
Last week we had Flow Executive Director Liz Kirkwood and MEC's Kate Madigan on our podcast. This week our Simon Schuster was able to talk about the Line 5 project through the eyes of the Enbridge folks. And we've got Ryan Duffy on the other end of the line talking with Simon Schuster.
Spoke with the Michigan Environmental Council and some other advocates last week who talked about their goal to have the Line 5 shut down within 10 years. Do you think that that's a realistic solution for transporting oil across the straits?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, we have no plans going in that direction whatsoever. I mean, our plan is to continue to operate Line 5 safely, as we've been doing for the last 60 years. Line 5 was built to protect the straits and to be a better alternative to moving oil by boat through the straits. So that was the original intention of it, you know, back in 1953, and we've operated it safely since then, and we plan to continue to keep doing that and to provide the energy that a lot of people in Michigan count on us to provide, you know, for them in their lives every day.
And so one of the things that they had talked about as a proposed solution for if, you know, they could get this pipeline shut down is having this oil move through Line 6 instead. And can you speak a little bit about some of the barriers to that?
Right. Well, it's not just like a roadway system, you know, as far as these pipelines go. You can't just kind of change the traffic on the roads. Each one of our pipelines and all pipelines in the state, you know, they're carefully planned out. They're permitted, you know, there's a lot of regulations before you can even start building one, and they each have to have a very specific need and intention, and so, you know, all of our lines carry different things and different amounts. Each line is different. You can't just kind of switch out what the lines carry at any given time. And our other lines are more or less at capacity, you know, that run down in the southern part of the state. And so, you know, you can't just put what Line 5's carrying into one of these other pipes.
So let's say, hypothetically, the Line 5 was shut down. What would some of the alternatives would be? Would they be riskier or safer than what is currently being used?
Yeah, that's tough to talk about, being that it is, you know, hypothetical. So I can't really say, you know, what something like that would be. We have no plans to ever need to do that. You know, our plan is to continue to operate the line safely. And, you know, I think it's really important to look at what Line 5 does provide to people in Michigan and how important it is to the economy. That's something that, you know, people in this discussion really need to think about when talking about, you know, alternatives or other things they might want to do, because Michigan does use the most propane of any state in the country, and we provide 55% of that propane on Line 5 and 65% in the UP. 30% of the oil the line carries goes to Michigan area refineries to be used in Michigan and to be used in consumer products, plastics, medical devices, things like that. And we also transport about 14,000 barrels a day of oil produced in Michigan. So that gets on Line 5 and is taken down to the refineries. So, you know, that's just part of some of what Line 5 does, and it is important to Michigan's economy.
So from your perspective, to use an alternative like shipping it via rail car or, you know, semi-trailer, that would all be less efficient and perhaps riskier than it would be transporting it via pipeline?
Yeah, I think that's been, you know, stated time and time again by the DOT and other agencies. I mean, people rely on us for this energy, so there is a need in Michigan for what Line 5 provides. And then the DOT has said that pipelines are the very safest way there is to transport this energy.
Now, I know that Enbridge has partnered with federal agencies to conduct sort of these mock scenarios where, in response to a potential oil spill, you know, repeatedly. So I'm curious, Michigan has had a few brutal winters in the past few years. If the straits were iced over, perhaps, you know, what would be done then to address a spill?
Ice conditions and responding potentially to, you know, a release in the winter, that's a very important part of our emergency response training and what we do to prepare. So, you know, we do look at that, and we are prepared. You know, if something were to happen, on the off chance that were to ever happen in the winter, in the ice conditions, you know, we've operated there in the straits for more than 60 years. We know what winter's like. We know how we would respond to that, and we do have the people and equipment there in place in the Straits region if that ever were to happen. But, of course, you know, most of our attention is focused on, first and foremost, preventing any spills in the first place.
But has Enbridge ever responded to a scenario under these circumstances before where the water is iced over and there is, you know, barriers to accessing where this pipeline may have ruptured?
No, I mean, fortunately, because of the safety measures we have in place, we've never had any kind of incident in the Straits in more than 60 years. So we've never actually had to do that, thankfully. But we do work with contractors. We work with emergency response experts and consultants who are very familiar with response in ice conditions. I mean, these are guys who responded to things that have happened, you know, in Alaska, in the Arctic. And so we hire them to be on standby just in case we would ever need them. And also, we did earlier this year invest in $7 million worth of new emergency response equipment to be ready in ice conditions. And, you know, a lot of that equipment was specifically for improving our response capabilities in ice conditions. And so that's something we're implementing now, getting that equipment in place. We're going to stage it around the straits so that we will potentially be even better at ice response. You know, we are, of course, hoping to never, ever have to use that, and hopefully it'll just sit here in the straits and not do anything. But, you know, our goal is to be over-prepared and underutilized as far as some of this new equipment we have.
So you would say that any assertions by the Michigan Environmental Council that Enbridge couldn't clean up an ice spill or doesn't know how would be inaccurate?
Very much so, definitely. I mean, that's completely inaccurate. Part of what we have to do as a company is file these plans with our regulator, PHMSA, and we have to show them how we are prepared and how we would respond. And so that's something we're required to do. But we're, on top of that, always working to improve and get better and have the very best technology and equipment in place.
So what do you see as the long-term horizon for Line 5? You know, where is this pipeline going to be 10, 25, 50 years down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to continue to provide the energy that people here in Michigan need. I mean, we're going to continue to do that as long as they're relying on us for that and relying on us for propane and for meeting those needs. We're going to continue to provide it, and we're going to continue to maintain the line as we've done and keep it in the good condition that it's in right now. I mean, I think a lot of people don't understand all we do to keep Line 5 so safe, but there is a very layered safety process that goes into it. I mean, I can talk to you about it for quite a long time, but it has to do with how we operate it. We operate it at a very low pressure, you know, far lower than what it's tested to be able to handle. So it's operated at a low pressure. We monitor it there in the Straits 24/7 from our control center. If anything were to happen, we see that right away. And then on top of that, we have automatic shutoff valves on both sides of the Straits there. We're constantly doing inspections on it. We have tools that go on the inside of the pipe. We have tools that inspect the outside of the pipe. So we're constantly analyzing it. And then, as I talked about, on the off chance that something were ever to happen, we are over prepared to respond and ready to go, and we have emergency response plans in place. But then, you know, on top of all that, it's just how this line was built back in the 50s. It was built to such incredibly high standards, you know, even better than some of the standards that are used now on new pipeline construction. It splits off from the 130-inch pipe into the two 20-inch diameter pipes. You know, that's partly for safety. It's our thickest pipe at almost an inch thick there through the straits. And then the special coating, the fiber-reinforced coating that was used at that time, it's held up incredibly well. It's kept all corrosion off the pipes there through the straits. And so really, all of that is what goes into keeping the line in such good condition.
Well, Mr. Duffy, I think that'll just about do it. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Ryan Duffy for making time with us today. Tom Shields and TJ Buchholz. I'm Kyle Malin for Simon Schuster and Jack Spencer. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday. Until next week, take care.